footnotes or addenda or appendices. Updates? He asked.
Always, Bill Antonio said. We never sleep.
So what's new?
Animal DNA,
Bill Antonio said.
Exact match of Barr's dog's hair to the scene.
Where's the dog now?
Put to sleep.
That's cold.
That's cold.
The damn dog didn't do anything wrong. Bill Antonio said nothing. What else? Reacher asked.
More tests on the fibers and more ballistics. We're beyond definite on everything. The Lake City ammo was relatively rare, and we've confirmed a purchase by Barr less than a year ago in Kentucky.
He used a range down there.
Bill Antonio nodded. We found that out, too.
Anything else?
The traffic cone came from the city's construction department. We don't know how or when.
Anything else?
I think that's about it.
What about the negatives?
The negatives?
You're giving me all the good news. What about the questions that didn't get answered?
I don't think there were any.
You sure about that?
I'm sure.
Reacher glanced around the square of cork boards one more time and carefully. You play poker? He asked.
No.
Good decision. You're a terrible liar. Bill Antonio said nothing. You should start worrying, Reacher said. He slides, he's going to sue your ass for the dog.
He won't slide, Bill Antonio said.
No, Reacher said. I don't suppose he will.
Emerson was waiting outside Bill Antonio's door. Jacket on, tie off. Frustration in his eyes, the way cops get when they're snagged up in lawyer stuff.
Did you see him? He asked. At the hospital?
He's blank from Tuesday night onward, Reacher said.
You got a battle on your hands.
Terrific.
You should run safer jails.
Roden will bring experts in.
His daughter already did.
There are legal precedents.
They go both ways, apparently.
You want to see that piece of shit back on the street?
Your screw-up, Reacher said, not mine.
As long as you're happy.
Nobody's happy, Reacher said. Not yet.
He left the police station and walked all the way back to the black glass tower. Helen Roden was at her desk studying a sheet of paper. Danuta and Mason and Niebuhr had left. She was alone.
Rosemary asked her brother about Kuwait City, she said. She told me so when she came out of his room at the hospital.
And? Reacher said.
He told her it was all true.
Not a fun conversation, probably.
Helen Roden shook her head.
Rosemary is pretty devastated. She says James is, too. He can't believe he did it again. Can't believe he threw 14 years away.
Reacher said nothing. Silence in the office. Then Helen showed Reacher the sheet of paper she was reading.
Eileen Hutton is a brigadier general, she said.
Then she's done well, Reacher said. She was a major when I knew her.
What were you?
A captain.
Wasn't that illegal?
Technically, for her.
She was in the JAG Corps.
Lawyers can break the law same as anyone else.
She's still in the JAG Corps.
Obviously. They don't retrain them.
Based in the Pentagon.
That's where they keep the smart people.
She'll be here tomorrow.
Reacher said nothing.
For her deposition, Helen said.
Reacher said nothing.
It's scheduled for 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Chances are she'll fly down in the morning and check in somewhere, because she'll have to stay the night in town. Too late for a flight back.
You going to ask me to take her out for dinner?
No, Helen said. I'm not. I'm going to ask you to take her out for lunch. before she meets with my father. I need to know in advance what she's here for.
They put Barr's dog to sleep, Reacher said.
It was old.
That doesn't bother you.
Should it?
The dog didn't do anything to anyone.
Helen said nothing.
Which hotel will Hutton use? Reacher asked.
I have no idea. You'll have to catch her at the airport.
What flight?
I don't know that either. But there's nothing direct from D.C., so I expect she'll change planes in Indianapolis. She won't get here before 11 in the morning.
Reacher said nothing.
I apologize,
Helen said,
for telling Danuta we didn't have any evidence for the puppet master. I didn't mean it to sound dismissive.
You were right, Reacher said. We didn't have any evidence at the time. She looked at him.
But?
We do now.
What?
They've been gilding the lily over at the police station. They've got fibers, ballistics, dog DNA, a receipt for the ammunition all the way from some place in Kentucky. They trace the traffic cone to the city. They've got all kinds of stuff.
But,
Helen said again, but they haven't got James Barr on tape, driving in to place the cone in the garage beforehand.
Are you sure?
Reacher nodded. They must have looked at the tapes a dozen times by now. If they had found him, they'd have printed the stills and pinned them up for the world to see. But they're not there, which means they didn't find them, which means James Barr didn't drive in and leave the cone beforehand.
Which means someone else did.
The puppet master, Reacher said, or another of his puppets, sometime after Tuesday night. Barr thinks the cone was still in his garage, Tuesday.
Helen looked at him again. Whoever it was must be on the tapes.
Correct, Reacher said.
But there'll be hundreds of cars.
You can narrow it down some. You're looking for a sedan, something too low slung to get itself down a farm track.
The puppet master really exists, doesn't he?
No other explanation for how it went down.
Alan Danuta is probably right, you know, Helen said. My father will trade Barr for the puppet master. He'd be a fool not to.
Reacher said nothing.
Which means Barr is going to walk, Helen said. You understand that, right? There's no alternative. The prosecution's legal problems are overwhelming.
Reacher said nothing.
I'm not happy about it either, Helen said. But for me, it's just a PR problem. I can spin my way out of it. At least I hope I can. I can blame it all on the way the jail was run. I can claim that it wasn't me who got him off.
But, Reacher said,
what are you going to do? You came here to bury him, and he's going to walk.
I don't know what I'm going to do, Reacher said. What choices do I have?
Only two that I'm scared of. One, you could give up on helping me find the guy who's pulling the strings. I can't do it alone, and Emerson won't even be willing to try.
And two,
you could settle things with Barr yourself.
That's for sure.
But you can't do that. You'd go to prison for life, if you were lucky.
If I got caught.
You would get caught. I would know you did it. Reacher smiled.
You'd rat me out?
I would have to,
Helen said. Not if you were my lawyer. You couldn't say a word.
I'm not your lawyer.
I could hire you.
Rosemary Barr would know, too. And she'd rat you out in a heartbeat. And Franklin, he heard you tell the story.
Reacher nodded. I don't know what I'm going to do, he said again.
How do we find this guy?
Like you said, why would I want to?
Because I don't think you're the type who settles for half a loaf.
Reacher said nothing.
I think you want the truth, Helen said. I don't think you like it when the wool gets pulled over your eyes. You don't like being played for a sucker.
Reacher said nothing.
Plus, this whole situation stinks, Helen said. There were 6 victims here. The 5 who died, and Barr himself.
That expands the definition of victimhood a little too far for me.
Dr. Niebuhr expects we'll find a pre-existing relationship, probably recent, some new friend. We could go at it that way.
Barr told me he doesn't have any new friends, Reacher said. Only has 1 or 2 old friends.
Was he telling the truth?
I think he was.
So is Niebuhr wrong?
Niebuhr's guessing. He's a shrink. All they do is guess.
I could ask Rosemary.
Would she know his friends?
Probably. They're pretty close.
So get a list, Reacher said.
Is Dr. Mason guessing, too?
No question. But in her case, I think she's guessing right.
If Niebuhr's wrong about the friend, what do?
We go proactive.
How?
There had to have been a guy following me last night, and I know for sure there was one following me this morning. I saw him out there in the plaza. So the next time I see him, I'll have a word with him. He'll tell me who he's working for.
Just like that.
People usually tell me what I want to know.
Why?
Because I ask them nicely.
Don't forget to ask Eileen Hutton nicely.
I'll see you around, Reacher said.
He walked south beyond his hotel and found a cheap place to eat dinner. Then he walked north, slowly, through the plaza, past the black glass tower, under the highway, all the way back to the sports bar. Altogether, he was on the street the best part of an hour, and he saw nobody behind him. No damaged men in odd suits. Nobody at all. The sports bar was half empty, and there was baseball on every screen. He found a corner table and watched the Cardinals play the Astros in Houston. It was a listless late-season game between 2 teams well out of contention. During the commercial breaks, he watched the door. Saw nobody. Tuesday was even quieter than Monday, out there in the heartland.
Grigor Linsky dialed his cell.
"He's back in his sports bar," he said.
"Did he see you?" the Zek asked.
"No."
"Why is he in the sports bar again?"
"No reason. He needed a destination, that's all. He paraded around for nearly an hour, trying to make me show myself." Silence for a beat.
"Leave him there," the Zek said.
"Come in, and we'll talk."
Alex Roden called Emerson at home. Emerson was eating a late dinner with his wife and his 2 daughters, and he wasn't thrilled about taking the call. But he did. He went out to the hallway and sat on the 2nd-to-bottom stair, leaning forward, his elbows on his knees, the phone trapped between his shoulder and his ear.
"We need to do something about this Jack Reacher guy," Roden said to him.
"I don't see how he's a huge problem," Emerson said.
"Maybe he wants to, but he can't make the facts go away. We've got more than we need on Barr."
"This is not about facts now," Roden said. "It's about the amnesia. It's about how hard the defense is going to push it."
"That's up to your daughter."
"He's a bad influence on her. I've been reading the case law. It's a real gray area. The test isn't really about whether Barr remembers the day in question. It's about whether he understands the process right now, today, and whether we've got enough other stuff on him to convict without his direct testimony."
"I would say we do."
"Me too. But Helen needs to swallow that. She needs to agree." But she's got that guy standing over her all the time, turning her head. I know her. She's not going to suck it up until he's out of the picture. I don't see what I can do. I want you to bring him in.
I can't, Emerson said. Not without a complaint.
Roden went quiet.
Well, keep an eye on him, he said. He spits on the sidewalk. I want you to bring him in and do something to him.
This isn't the Wild West, Emerson said. I can't run him out of town.
An arrest might be enough. We need something that breaks the spell. He's pushing Helen where she doesn't want to go. I know her. On her own, she'll give Barr up. No question.
Linsky was in pain on the way back to his car. An hour on his feet was about all he could take. A long time ago, the bones in his spine had been methodically cracked with an engineer's ball-peen hammer, one after the other, starting with the coccyx and moving upward through all the lower vertebrae, and not in rapid sequence. Generally, one bone had been allowed to heal before the next was broken. When the last had healed, they had started over again. Playing the xylophone, they had called it. Playing scales. Ultimately, he had lost count of how many scales they had played on him. But he never spoke of it. Worse had happened to the Zek. The Cadillac had a soft seat, and it was a relief to get in. It had a quiet motor, and a gentle ride, and a nice radio. Cadillacs were the kind of things that made America such a wonderful place, along with the trusting population and the hamstrung police departments. Linsky had spent time in several different countries, and there was no question in his mind about which was the most satisfactory. Elsewhere, he had walked, or run, or crawled through dirt or hauled carts and sleds by hand. Now he drove a Cadillac. He drove it to the Zek's house, which stood 8 miles north and west of town, next to his stone-crushing plant. The plant was a 40-year-old industrial facility built on a rich limestone seam that had been discovered under farmland. The house was a big, fancy palace built 100 years ago, when the landscape was still unspoiled, for a rich dry goods merchant. It was bourgeois and affected in every way, but it was a comfortable house in the same way that the Cadillac was a comfortable car. Best of all, it stood alone in the center of many acres of flat land. Once there had been beautiful gardens, but the Zek had raised the trees and leveled the shrubberies to create a completely flat and open vista all around. There were no fences, because how could the Zek bear to live another day behind wire? For the same reason, there were no extra locks, no bolts, no bars. The openness was the Zek's gift to himself, but it was also excellent security in its own right. There were surveillance cameras. Nobody could approach the house undetected. By day, visitors were clearly visible at least 200 yards away, and after dark, night vision enhancement picked them up only a little closer. Linsky parked and eased himself out of the car. The night was quiet. The stone-crushing plant shut down at 7 every evening, and sat brooding and silent until dawn. Linsky glanced in its direction and walked toward the house. The front door opened before he got near it. Warm light spilled out, and he saw that Vladimir himself had come down to welcome him, which meant that Chenko had to be there too, upstairs, which meant that the Zek had assembled all his top boys, which meant that the Zek was worried. Linsky took a breath, but he walked inside without a moment's hesitation. After all, what could be done to him that hadn't been done to him before? It was different for Vladimir and Chenko, but for men with Linsky's age and experience,
Nothing was entirely unimaginable anymore. Vladimir said nothing, just closed the door again and followed Linsky upstairs. It was a three-story house. The first floor was used for nothing at all, except surveillance. All the rooms were completely empty, except one that had four TV screens on a long table showing wide-angle views north, east, south, and west. Sokolov would be in there watching them, or Raskin. They alternated 12-hour shifts. The second floor of the house had a kitchen, a dining room, a living room, and an office. The third floor had bedrooms and bathrooms. The second floor was where all the business was done. Linsky could hear the Zek's voice from the living room calling him. He went straight in without knocking. The Zek was in an armchair with a glass of tea clamped between his palms. Chenko was sprawled on a sofa. Vladimir pushed in behind Linsky and sat down next to Chenko. Linsky stood still and waited.
"Sit, Grigor," the Zek said. "Nobody's upset at you. It was the boy's failure."
Linsky nodded and sat down in an armchair, a little closer to the Zek than Chenko was. That maintained the hierarchy in the proper order. The Zek was 80, and Linsky himself was more than 60. Chenko and Vladimir were both in their 40s. Important men, for sure, but comparative youngsters. They didn't have the history that the Zek and Linsky shared. Not even close.
"Tea?" the Zek asked in Russian.
"Please," Linsky said.
"Chenko," the Zek said, "bring Grigor a glass of tea."
Linsky smiled inside. Chenko being made to serve him tea was a statement of the greatest importance, and he noted that Chenko did it with no unwillingness. He just got up out of his slouch and went out to the kitchen and came back in with a glass of tea on a small silver tray. Chenko was a very small man, short, wiry, no bulk at all. He had coarse black hair that stuck up in all directions, even though he kept it cropped short. Vladimir was different. Vladimir was very tall and heavy and blonde, unbelievably strong. It was entirely possible that Vladimir had German genes somewhere in his background. Perhaps his grandmother had picked them up back in 1941. Like germs.
"We've been talking," the Zek said.
"And?"
Linsky said. "We have to confront the fact that we made a mistake. Just one, but it could prove irksome."
"The cone," Linsky said.
"Obviously, Barr isn't on tape placing it," the Zek said.
"Obviously."
"But will it be a problem?"
"Your opinion?" Linsky asked politely.
"Significance is in the eye of the beholder," the Zek said. "The detective Emerson and the D.A. Rodin won't care about it. It's a minor detail, one they won't feel inclined to pursue. Why would they? They're not looking to trip themselves up. And no case is ever 100% perfect, they know that. So they'll write it off as an inexplicable loose end. They might even convince themselves that Barr used a different vehicle.
But
it's still a loose end. If the soldier tugs on it, something might unravel.
The evidence against Barr is indisputable." The Zek nodded.
"That's true."
"So won't that be enough for them?"
"Certainly it would have been. But it's possible that Barr no longer exists. Not in the sense that he's a legal entity accessible to their jurisprudence. He has permanent retrograde amnesia. It's possible that Rodin won't be able to put him on trial. If so, Rodin will be extremely frustrated about that. He'll be expected to seek a consolation prize. And if the consolation prize were eventually to assume a higher profile than Barr himself, how could Roden turn it down?
Linsky sipped his tea. It was hot and sweet. "All this from a videotape," he said.
"It depends entirely on the soldier," the Zek said. "It depends on his tenacity and his imagination."
"He was a military cop," Chenko said in English. "Did you know that?" Linsky glanced at Chenko. Chenko rarely spoke English in the house. He had a perfect American accent, and sometimes Linsky thought he was ashamed of it.
"That doesn't necessarily impress me," Linsky said in Russian. "Or me," the Zek said. "But it's a factor we must weigh in the balance."
"Silencing him now would draw attention," Linsky said, "wouldn't it?"
"It would depend on how it was done."
"How many ways are there?"
"We could use a red-headed girl again," the Zek said.
"She would be no use against the soldier. He's a giant, and almost certainly extensively trained in self-defense."
"But he already has an established issue with her. Several people know she tried to set him up for a beating. Perhaps she could be found severely injured. If she was, the soldier would be the obvious prime suspect. We could let the police department silence him for us."
"She would know who attacked her," Vladimir said. "She would know it wasn't the soldier."
The Zek nodded appreciatively. Linsky watched him. He was accustomed to the Zek's methods. The Zek liked to tease solutions out of people, like Socrates of old.
"Then perhaps she should be left unable to tell anyone anything," the Zek said.
"Dead?"
"We've always found that the safest way, haven't we?"
"But it's possible she has many enemies," Vladimir said. "Not just him. Maybe she's a big-time prick-teaser."
"Then we should firm up the link. Possibly she should be found somewhere suggestive. Maybe he invited her out to renew their acquaintance."
"In his hotel?"
"No, outside his hotel, I think. But close by, where she can be discovered by someone other than the soldier himself. Someone who can call the police while the soldier is still asleep. That way, he's a sitting duck."
"Why would her body be outside his hotel?"
"Evidently he hit her, and she staggered away and collapsed before she got very far."
"The Metropole Palace," Linsky said. "That's where he is."
"When?" Chenko asked.
"Whenever you like," the Zek said.
The Astros beat the Cardinals 10-7 after a limp defensive performance by both franchises. Plenty of cheap hits, plenty of errors. A bad way to win and a worse way to lose. Reacher had stopped paying attention halfway through. He had started thinking about Eileen Hutton instead. She was part of his mosaic. He had seen her once in the States before the Gulf War, just briefly across a crowded courtroom, just long enough to register her head-turning quality, and he had assumed he would never see her again, which he figured was a pity. But then she had showed up in Saudi as part of the long, ponderous Desert Shield build-up. Reacher had been there pretty much from the start as a recently demoted captain. The first stage of any clean-sheet foreign deployment always resembled gang warfare between the MPs and the troops they were sent out with, but after 6 weeks or so, the situation usually settled down some, and Desert Shield wasn't any different. After 6 weeks, there was a structure in place, and in terms of military law enforcement, a structure demanded in-country personnel all the way up from jailers to judges,
and Hutton had shown up as one of the prosecutors they shipped in. Reacher had assumed it was volunteer duty for her, which he was happy about, because that made it likely she was unmarried. She was unmarried. First time their paths crossed, he checked her left hand and saw no ring. Then he checked her collar and saw a major's oak leaves. That would make it a challenge, he figured, for a recently demoted captain. Then he checked her eyes and saw that the challenge would be worth it. Her eyes were blue and full of intelligence and mischief, and promise, he figured, and adventure. He had just turned 31 years old, and he was up for anything. The desert heat helped. Most of the time, the temperature was above 120 degrees, and apart from regular gas attack practices, standard on-post dress devolved down to shorts and sleeveless undershirts. And in Reacher's experience, the close proximity of hot and nearly naked men and women always led somewhere good. Better than serving out November in Minnesota, that was for damn sure. The initial approach had promised to be tricky, given the disparity in rank, and when it came to it, he fumbled it slightly and was saved only because she was just as up for it as he was and wasn't afraid to let it show. After that, it had been as smooth as silk. 3 long months. Good times. Then new orders had come through, like they always did, eventually. He hadn't even said goodbye to her. Didn't get the chance. Never saw her again, either. I'll see her again tomorrow, he thought. He stayed in the bar until ESPN started recycling the highlights it had already shown once. Then he settled up his tab and stepped out to the sidewalk into the yellow glare of the streetlights. He decided he wouldn't go back to the Metropole Palace. He decided it was time for a change. No real reason, just his normal, restless instinct. Keep moving. Never stay in one place too long. And the Metropole was a gloomy old pile. Unpleasant, even by his undemanding standards. He decided to try the motor court instead, the one he had seen on his way to the auto parts store. The one next to the barber shop, any style, $7. Maybe he could get a haircut before Hutton blew into town. Chenko left the Zek's house at midnight. He took Vladimir with him. If the redhead was to be beaten to death, then Vladimir would have to do it. It had to look right, forensically. Chenko was too small to inflict the kind of battering that an enraged 6'5", 250-pound ex-soldier might be provoked to. But Vladimir was a different matter. Vladimir might well be able to do the job with a single blow, which might be convincing on the post-mortem slab. A refusal, an objection, a sexual taunt, a big man might lash out once in frustration, a little harder than he intended. They were both familiar with the girl. They had met her before because of her connection to Jeb Oliver. They had even all worked together once. They knew where she lived, which was in a rented garden apartment that nestled on a barren patch of land in the shadow of the state highway, where it first rose on its stilts south and west of downtown. And they knew that she lived there alone. Reacher walked a long, aimless three-block circle before approaching the motor court. He kept his own footsteps light and listened hard for the gritty crunch of a shadow behind him. He heard nothing, saw nothing. He was alone. The motor court was practically an antique. At one time, it must have been the latest thing, and consequently, fairly upmarket. But since then, the relentless march of time and fashion had left it behind. It was well maintained, but not updated. It was exactly the kind of place he liked. He roused the clerk and paid cash for one night only. He used the name Don Hefner, who had played second base
and hit 261 during the Yankees' lean year of 1934. The clerk gave him a big brass key and pointed him down the road to room number 8. The room was faded and a little damp. The counterpane on the bed and the drapes at the window looked original. So did the bathroom. But everything worked, and the door locked tight. He took a short shower and folded his pants and his shirt very carefully and put them flat under the mattress. That was as close as he ever got to ironing. They would look okay in the morning. He would shave and shower very carefully and go to the barber shop after breakfast. He didn't want to devalue whatever memories Hutton might have retained, assuming she had retained any at all. Chenko parked east of the highway, and he and Vladimir walked under it and approached the girl's apartment building from the back, unseen. They kept close to the wall and walked around to her door. Chenko told Vladimir to keep out of sight. Then he knocked, gently. There was no response, which wasn't entirely unexpected. It was late, and she was probably already in bed. So Chenko knocked again, a little louder, and again as loud as he dared. He saw a light come on in a window, heard the quiet shuffle of feet inside, heard her voice through the crack where the door met the jamb.
"Who's there?"
she asked.
"It's me," he said.
"What do you want?"
"We need to talk."
"I was asleep."
"I'm sorry."
"It's awful late."
"I know," Chenko said. "But it's very urgent." There was a pause.
"Wait a minute," she said.
Chenko heard her shuffle back toward her bedroom, then silence. Then she came back. The door opened. She was standing there, clutching a blue robe around her.
"What?"
she said.
"You need to come with us," Chenko said.
Vladimir stepped out of the shadow.
"Why is he here?"
Sandy asked.
"He's helping me tonight," Chenko said.
"What do you want?"
"You need to go out."
"Like this? I can't."
"I agree," Chenko said. "You need to get dressed. Like for a date."
"A date?"
"You need to look really good."
"But I'll have to shower. Do my hair."
"We have time."
"A date with who?"
"You just have to be seen, like you were ready for a date."
"At this time of night? The whole town is asleep."
"Not the whole town. We're awake, for instance."
"How much do I get?"
200, Chenko said. "Because it's so late."
"How long will it take?"
"Just a minute. You just have to be seen walking somewhere."
"I don't know.
200 for a minute's work isn't bad."
"It isn't a minute's work. It'll take me an hour to get ready."
250, then, Chenko said.
"Okay,"
Sandy said. Chenko and Vladimir waited in her living room, listening through the thin walls, hearing the shower running, hearing the hair dryer, the held breaths as she put on her makeup, the elastic snap of undergarments, the whisper of fabric on skin. Chenko saw that Vladimir was restless and sweating, not because of the task ahead, but because there was a woman in a state of undress in a nearby room. Vladimir was unreliable in certain situations. Chenko was glad he was there to supervise. If he hadn't been, the plan would have derailed for sure. Sandy walked into the living room after an hour, looking, as the Americans would say, like $1 million. She was wearing a filmy black blouse that was nearly transparent. Underneath it was a black bra that molded her breasts into twin mounds of implausible roundness. She had on tight black pants that ended just below the knee. Pedal pushers, capri pants, Chenko wasn't sure of the name. She was wearing black, high-heeled shoes. With her pale skin and her red hair and her green eyes, she looked like a picture in a magazine. Pity, Chenko thought.
My money?
Sandy asked. Afterward, Chenko said, when we bring you back.
Let me see it.
Ah, it's in the car.
So let's go look at it,
Sandy said. They walked in single file. Chenko led the way, Sandy came next. Vladimir brought up the rear. They walked under the highway. The car was right there ahead of them. It was cold and misted over. There was no money in it. None at all. Chenko knew that. So he stopped 6 feet short and turned around. Nodded to Vladimir. Now, he said. Vladimir reached forward with his right hand and put it on Sandy's right shoulder from behind. He used it to turn her upper body sideways, and then he crashed his left fist into her right temple, a little above and in front of her ear. It was a colossal blow, explosive. Her head snapped violently sideways and around, and her legs gave way, and she fell to the ground vertically like an empty suit of clothes slipping off a hanger. Chenko squatted down next to her, waited a moment for the body to settle, and then felt the neck for a pulse. There wasn't one.
You broke her neck, he said.
Vladimir nodded.
It's about placement, he said. The main vector is mostly sideways, obviously, but you try for a little rotation, too. So it's not so much a break, it's more like a wrenching action, like a hangman's noose. Is your hand okay?
It will be tender tomorrow.
Good work. I try my best.
They unlocked the car and raised the rear armrest and laid the body across the back seat. There was just enough space, side to side. She had been a small girl, not tall. Then they got in the front together and drove off. They looped well to the east and came up on the Metropole Palace from behind. They avoided the bay where the garbage was piled and found a side alley. They stopped outside a fire exit. Vladimir slid out and opened the rear door, pulled the body out by the shoulders and left it where it fell. Then he got back in. Chenko drove on and paused after 5 yards and turned in his seat. The body was lying in a heap against the alley's far wall, directly opposite the fire door. It looked like a plausible scenario. She had fled the soldier's room in shame and panic, chosen not to wait for the elevator, and run down the fire stairs and out into the night. Maybe she had stumbled at that point and aggravated an injury already done to her. Maybe she had tripped and fallen against the wall and the shock had dislodged an already wrenched vertebra. Chenko turned back and faced front and drove on. Not fast, not slow, not drawing attention, not standing out. 8 miles north and west, all the way back to the Zex house. Chapter 8. Reacher woke himself up at 7 in the morning and went out to check for a tail and to look for a drugstore. He walked a zigzag half mile and saw nobody behind him. He found a drugstore 2 blocks east of the motor court and bought black coffee in a cardboard cup, a pack of throwaway razors, a can of shaving foam, and a new tube of toothpaste. He carried his purchases back by a roundabout route and put his clothes back under the mattress and sat on the bed and drank the coffee. Then he showered and shaved, using his full 22-minute routine. He washed his hair twice. Then he dressed again and went out for breakfast to the only place he could find, which was the drive-thru he had seen the day before. It had a small counter inside. He had more coffee and an English muffin filled with a round piece of ham and something that might have once been egg, first dried and powdered and then reconstituted. His threshold of culinary acceptability was very low,
but right then he felt he might be pushing at the bottom edge of his personal envelope. He followed the muffin with a piece of lemon pie for a sugar hit. It was better than the muffin, so he had a second piece with a second cup of coffee. Then he walked south to the barber shop. He pulled the door and sat down in the chair at 8:30 exactly. By which time, the homicide investigation outside the Metropole Palace was already 3 hours old. The body in the alley had been discovered at 5:30 in the morning by a cleaner coming in to work. The cleaner was a middle-aged man from Honduras. He didn't touch the body, didn't check for vital signs. The way it was lying there told him all he needed to know. The slack emptiness of death is recognizable anywhere. The guy just rushed inside and told the night porter. Then he went home again, because he had no green card and didn't want to be around a police investigation. The night porter dialed 911 from the desk phone and then went out through the fire door to take a look. Came back inside 30 seconds later, not having enjoyed it. Two patrol cars and an ambulance showed up within 8 minutes. Paramedics confirmed the DOA and the ambulance went away. The patrolman blocked off the alley and the fire exit and then took a statement from the night porter. He said he had stepped out for some air and discovered the body himself to protect the illegal from Honduras. It was close to true. Certainly, the patrolman had no reason to doubt his word. They just stood back and waited for Emerson. Emerson got there by 6:25. He brought his number to a woman called Donna Bianca and the city ME and Bel Antonio himself to run the crime scene. Technical work occupied the first 30 minutes. Measurement, photography, the accumulation of trace evidence. Then Emerson got the okay and stepped close to the body and ran into his first major problem. The girl had no purse and no ID. Nobody had the slightest idea who she was. Agnani showed up behind the Metropole at 7:15. She had an NBC crew with her, consisting of a cameraman and a sound guy with a microphone on a long boom. The microphone had a gray fur windsock on it, and the boom was 10 feet long. The guy put his hips against the police tape and extended his arms as far as he could and heard Emerson's voice in his headphones. Emerson was talking to Bianca about prostitution. The ME had checked the girl's arms and thighs and between her toes and found no needle tracks, so she hadn't been there to score. So maybe she was hooking. Who else would come out the side door of a downtown hotel in the middle of the night, dressed like that? She was young, and she still had her looks. Therefore, she wouldn't have been cheap. Therefore, she would have been carrying a big purse full of 20s that had just come out of some businessman's ATM. She had run into somebody waiting for her. Either somebody waiting for her specifically, or somebody waiting on the off chance for someone like her. Whoever, he had snatched her purse and hit her in the head, a little harder than necessary. A 19- or 20-year-old who wasn't an addict wouldn't necessarily have been fingerprinted unless she had a vice conviction somewhere. Emerson wasn't willing to count on that. Therefore, he didn't expect to discover her identity through the databases. He expected to discover it inside the hotel, either from the night porter who had pimped her in and out, or through the John who had called her. "Nobody leaves," he said to Bianca. "We'll talk to all the guests and all the staff one by one. So find a room somewhere, and tell all units to be on the lookout for a guy with more new 20s than he should have."
"A big guy,"
Bianca said. Emerson nodded. "A real big guy. That was some punch." The ME took the body away to the morgue, and Donna Bianca commandeered the hotel bar, and the interviews were 2/3 through by 8:30 in the morning. The barber was a competent old guy who had probably been cutting the same style for close to 50 years. He went for what the military would have called a white wall. He left an inch and a half on the top and used his clippers to shave the bottom and the sides up toward it. Then he flipped the clippers over and squared off the sideburns and cleaned the fuzz off the neck. It was a style Reacher was familiar with. He had worn it most of his life, except for periods when he had been too lazy to care, and a couple of six-month stretches when he had favored an all-over number one buzz cut. The barber did the thing with the hand mirror to show Reacher the back.
"Happy?" he asked.
Reacher nodded. It looked okay, except that there was a half-inch margin all around where his skin was dead white. He had had longer hair in Miami, and the tan hadn't penetrated. The barber brushed the clippings off his collar and removed the towel. Reacher gave him his $7 and tipped him $1. Then he walked around the block. Nobody followed him. He unlocked his room and washed his face and shaved under his sideburns again. There was a new half-inch of stubble there. The barber's clippers had been a little blunt. The Metropole interviews were finished by 9:20, and they gave Emerson absolutely nothing at all. The night porter swore blind that he knew nothing about the girl. There were only 11 guests, and none of them was promising. Emerson was an experienced and talented detective, and he knew that people sometimes tell the truth. And he knew that accepting the truth was as important a part of a detective's professional arsenal as rejecting lies. So he conferred with Donna Bianca, and together they concluded they had just wasted the best part of 3 hours on a faulty hunch. Then a guy named Gary called from the auto parts store. Gary had gotten to work at 8 and had found himself really short-staffed. There was still no sign of Jeb Oliver, and Sandy hadn't shown either. At first he had been annoyed. He had called her apartment and gotten no reply. On her way, he had assumed, late. But she never showed. Thereafter, he called every 30 minutes. By 9:30, the annoyance had given way to worry, and he started thinking about auto wrecks. So he called the cops for information. The desk guy told them there had been no traffic accidents that morning. Then there was a pregnant pause, and the desk guy seemed to consider another possibility and asked for a name and a description. Gary said, "Alexandra Dupre, known as Sandy, 19 years old, white, petite, green and red." 10 seconds after that, Gary was speaking to a detective called Emerson on a cell phone. Gary agreed to close the store for the day, and Emerson sent a patrol car to pick him up. First stop was the morgue. Gary identified the body and was white and badly shaken when he arrived in Emerson's office. Donna Bianca calmed him down, and Emerson watched him carefully. Statistics show that women get killed by husbands, boyfriends, brothers, employers, and workmates in descending order of likelihood, well before passing strangers show up on the list of possible suspects. And sometimes a boyfriend and a workmate can be the same guy. But Emerson knew that Gary was in the clear. He was too shaken. No way could a person fake that kind of sudden shock and surprise over something he had already known about for 8 or 10 hours. So Emerson started in, gently, with all the usual cop questions. "Last time you saw her? Know anything about her private life? Family? Boyfriends? Ex-boyfriends? Weird phone calls? Did she have any enemies, problems, money troubles?" And then, inevitably, "Anything unusual over the last couple of days?" And so by 10:15, Emerson knew all about the stranger that had come to the store the day before. Very tall, heavily built, tan, aggressive, demanding,
wearing olive-green pants and an olive-green flannel shirt. He had spent two mysterious sessions with Sandy in the back office and had borrowed her car and had demanded Jeb Oliver's address with menace, and Jeb Oliver was missing, too. Emerson left Gary with Donna Bianca and went out to the corridor and used his cell to call Alex Roden in his office.
"Your lucky day," he said. "We've got a 19-year-old female homicide victim. Someone broke her neck."
"How does that make me lucky?"
"Her last unexplained contact was yesterday at her place of work with a guy that sounds a whole lot like our pal Jack Reacher."
"Really?"
"We got a pretty good description from her boss. And her neck was busted by a single blow to the side of the head, which ain't easy, unless you're built like Reacher is."
"Who was the girl?"
"A redhead from the auto parts store out toward the highway. There's also a boy missing from the same store."
"Where did this thing happen?"
"Outside the Metropole Palace Hotel."
"Is that where Reacher is staying?"
"Not according to the register."
"So is he a suspect or not?"
"Right now, he looks pretty damn good for it."
"So when are you going to bring him in?"
"As soon as I find him."
"I'll call Helen," Alex Roden said. "She'll know where he is."
Roden lied to his daughter. He told her that Bellantonio needed to see Reacher to correct a possible misunderstanding about part of the prosecution's evidence.
"What part?" Helen asked.
"Just something they discussed. Probably nothing important, but I'm playing this very cautiously. Don't want to hand you grounds for an appeal."
"The traffic cone," Helen thought.
"He's on his way to the airport," she said.
"Why?"
"To say hello to Eileen Hutton."
"They know each other?"
"Apparently."
"That's unethical."
"To know each other?"
"To influence her testimony."
"I'm sure he won't do that."
"When will he be back?"
"After lunch, I think."
"Okay," Roden said. "It'll keep."
But it didn't keep, of course. Emerson left for the airport immediately. He had met Reacher twice face-to-face and could pick him out of a crowd. Donna Bianca went with him. They went in together through a restricted area and found the security office that looked out over the whole arrivals hall through one-way glass. They scanned the waiting faces carefully. No sign of Reacher. Not here yet. So they settled down to wait.
Chapter 9. Reacher didn't go to the airport. He knew better. Senior military personnel spend a lot of time flying small aircraft, either fixed wing or rotary, and they don't like it. Outside of combat, more military personnel die in plane crashes than from any other single cause. Therefore, given a choice, a smart brigadier general like Eileen Hutton wouldn't ride a puddle jumper down from Indianapolis. She would be happy enough with a big jet out of Washington National, but she wouldn't contemplate a twin prop for the final leg of her journey. No way. She would rent a car instead. So Reacher walked south and east to the library, asked the subdued woman at the desk where the yellow pages were stored. He went where she pointed and hauled the book out onto a table, opened it to H4 Hotels, started looking. Almost certainly some JAG Corps office grunt had done the equivalent thing the previous day, but remotely, probably online. Hutton would have told him to book her a room. He would have been anxious to please, so he would have turned first to the street map and found the courthouse and the road in from the north. Then he would have chosen a decent place convenient for both, somewhere with parking for the rental car. Probably a chain, with an established government rate accessible by a code number.
The Marriott Suites, Reacher thought. That's where she'll be headed.
Off the highway, south toward town, an obvious left turn east, and there it was, 3 blocks north of the courthouse, an easy walk, breakfast included. The office grunt had probably printed out driving directions from the internet